Wilma asked me to talk a little bit about my career and some of the research I've done throughout my career, and I thought this was probably a pretty good approach to it, because I get a lot of students into my lab and they come in and I think they think that they shouldn't make mistakes. And I tell them, just get in the lab and do something. Just go ahead and do. Don't worry about making mistakes. Because mistakes are how you learn. And as a matter of fact, it really is true that some of the most interesting results I've found during my whole career has been due to some pretty stupid things I did. This is the boll weevil, Anthonymus grandis. This was an invasive species in the United States starting about 1910, 1915, and it was really a serious pest of cotton. It's now been eradicated from the continental U.S. I've always considered it a beneficial insect since it put me through graduate school, but it was a serious pest, and so my job was to isolate and identify the sex pheromone of this boll weevil when I was a graduate student. And it turns out that you can sex the weevils and you can get the pheromone from the males. It's produced by the males. But this is a very tedious task. And it turned out to be very fortunate that you could get the pheromone in the fecal material, or the frass. And so I could just go down to the rearing room. We had a huge rearing room there, and sweep up the frass from the rearing operation. And by doing that, I was able to get about, not all at once, but about 54 kilograms of boll weevil frass. I translate to over 100 pounds, and I steam distilled it and began to isolate and identify the active fractions. This is part of the separation scheme that I used, and of course this separation was facilitated by a bioassay. It was actually developed in Dick Hardy's lab, and this is one of the things that's characteristic of any research like this, particularly interdisciplinary research. In this area of chemical ecology, it works best if you've got a good biologist working with a good chemist. And Dick Hardy was an excellent collaborator, and he developed this bioassay, and essentially you release the weevils here in the center of this arena, and you're pulling air this way, and you're pulling air in from each side, and of course you can put your sample on one side and a blank on the other, or compare samples in this way. So in doing this, what we were able to find out was that we actually had two active fractions from our column chromatography, and just designate them FC1, FC2, but you had to put them back together. They weren't active alone, so you had to combine them to get activity, and we followed this down through a few separations like this, and always combining whatever fraction we got here with this. Now, this wasn't new, because Dave Wood, who's sitting in the back there, and Milt Silverstein, had preceded us a little bit with some bark beetle work and shown that synergism actually did occur. You needed synergism in insect pheromones. And so then we were able to take each one of those LC fractions and put them on gas chromatography and collect fractions. And what we found was that this peak 8, when collected and combined with peak 6, together, they were synergistic and they gave activity in this bioassay. And so the idea was then to go ahead and purify these. So I took peak 8, and I shot it on another column on the GC, and I got two peaks like this. And of course, being a good chemist, I fractionated it the way you normally would and cut out the peaks like this, and went back and combined it with each one of them with peak 6 from the other separation from the other column, and essentially got nothing. Lost all the activity, and I did this several times. Well, I must have screwed up, I must have done this, because it was obviously one peak in this fraction and one peak in the other one that was active. But I had an undergraduate student working with me, and I let her fractionate collect the fractions off the GC, and one day she didn't do it right. She didn't do what I told her. She did it this way. And I thought, oh my, well, let's see, I wonder if that's even worth bioassaying. I guess I might as well test it and see what happens. And when I did, so I added this fraction to peak 6, and this fraction to peak 6, and lo and behold, this fraction to peak 6, and lo and behold, bingo, this was active. So by not doing what I told her, she had gotten activity off the GC. Now, if we'd have just thrown those away and kept on trying to cut out single peaks, I don't know where, how long it would have taken. I mean, today this seems really trivial. Everybody knows that you can have complex blends and everything, but in those days, really no one had found, to my knowledge, this degree of synergism where you need at least two or three compounds. And so to summarize and make a long story short, what it turned out was that the boll weevil pheromone had four components, which was the most complex pheromone that had been identified at that time, and you must have this compound and this compound, these two alcohols, combined with either one of these two aldehydes. It works best if you have all four components together in order to get activity. So this was a case where eventually we worked it out, but at first it didn't work very well. But at least we didn't throw away that fraction where I thought everything had gone wrong. And that's another lesson I try to tell my students. Well, then we got to the Japanese beetle. And Japanese beetle is another invasive species that's not native to this country. And so we started working on this pheromone. And I had an excellent collaborator in this, Mick Klein. And here he was really hardworking. You can see here he spent all of his time on the golf course running around checking traps. But Mick really was a good guy. And we spent a lot of time working together. And his bioassay basically was we'd take the washings from the flasks that the beetles were raised in, and we'd fractionate that, and I'd send him fractions in a little vial, and he'd put it in a petri dish on the golf course and see how many beetles it attracted. And so this worked pretty well. And we got down to a fraction that looked like this, and we purified it, isolated, identified it, got all the GC and the mass spec and the NMR and all that, and we found out it was that this main peak here was a lactone with a side chain like this. And actually, these two compounds were identical, except in this one, the small peak was a trans isomer, and the big peak was a cis isomer. And so we purified them. Bob Doolittle in our lab synthesized them. I sent them back up to Mick, and he bioassayed them on the golf course, and this is what the natural product should look like. But when he tested the synthetic compounds that we'd sent up there, what he found was he didn't get any response to this. And as a matter of fact, he never got anything closer than about a foot around this dish. So this was really puzzling. And so we went back and we repurified and the synthetic and made sure it was 99.99% pure and checked it out and made sure it was identical to the natural product. We couldn't see anything wrong with it, but it just wasn't active. Now, the thing about this compound is it has an asymmetric carbon right here. And that means that it can exist in two enantiomeric forms. Now, everybody knew about chirality in those days, and we knew that sometimes one enantiomer would be active and the other one wouldn't. But nobody had ever really found, there was some work, similar work at that time on the gypsy moth pheromone, but nobody had ever found an instance where the enantiomer was a very strong inhibitor. So what we'd been synthesizing, of course, was a racemic mixture of these two enantiomers. Well, we finally got smart after Mick had tested the synthetic for two seasons, because you could only test this in the field for about 6 weeks each summer. And we figured out, well, we better go back and synthesize the enantiomers. So Bob Doolittle did that. And sure enough, here are the two enantiomers. This is the R enantiomer. And it turns out this is attractive to the beetle. And the S enantiomer, the opposite enantiomer, the mirror image, is highly inhibitory. As a matter of fact, as little as 1% or less of this mixed in with the correct enantiomer will totally shut down attraction. There's a reason for this. Walter Leal discovered this later on, looking at related species in Japan where this insect originated. It turns out that one species produces the S and the other one the R, and this is how you get the separation of the species. But we finally got it right after a few years. Now, here comes probably the biggest mistake that we ever made in our career. So we were looking at biological control. I was working with Joe Lewis, and we had a really nice symposium yesterday. And we were looking at biological control of agricultural pests with beneficial insects. This is a little wasp, and this wasp searches out and finds this caterpillar and stings it, and puts her egg inside, and of course then the wasp larvae destroys the host larvae eventually. And we asked a question, because there were a lot of problems trying to use beneficial insects for biological control. Well, how does that wasp, this tiny wasp, find its host in a cotton field. It looks like this. We know it does. We know they can be very effective, but it's really amazing because here's a caterpillar down here on this leaf, but here's this little wasp, and she can search that field and come in and find it. And we figured, well, it can't be random. It has to be some sort of chemical cue that allows that wasp to find the host when it's hidden down in the foliage or underneath the canopy or something like that. So Joe Lewis and I started working on this, trying to isolate and identify and find the chemical cues that allow the beneficial insects to find their herbivorous hosts. Well, if you know anything about plant chemistry, you know that, and if you knew anything about the wasp we were working with a wasp called the Micropleta scarcipes, and it specializes on just one or two Heliothis helicoverpa species, but its host species occur over a wide range of plants. And these are just chromatograms of one of the species feeding on different, the volatiles produced when it feeds on different plants. So you knew that the plant odor was going to be very different depending on which plant the host species was feeding on. So we developed this hypothesis, since we knew a whole lot about insect semiochemicals and chiromones and pheromones. And we said, well, since the parasitoids are specialists on Lepidoptera hosts that are prolificus, host location must depend on caterpillar-emitted chiromones. We figured there had to be a specific chemical cue that was given off by these host caterpillars that allowed the wasp to find them in all different locations, on different habitats, and on different plants and things like that. And then we ran the famous Dixie Cup experiment. At least it was famous in our lab. It probably wasn't to the rest of the world because we didn't say too much about it. I had a graduate student that was working on this, and we needed to we developed various samples and baits we wanted to test based on caterpillar frass and caterpillars and this sort of thing. And so, and the caterpillar feeding on the plant. And so he went up to Joe Lewis's lab to test these samples in the greenhouse, because Joe had, he was rearing the wasps there, and he had a greenhouse and we could release the wasps. And so he used the Dixie cups, and these are just small paper cups. Probably a lot of you are familiar with this, and you can get them in different sizes. And so he used these small paper cups to hold the samples and hang them around on the plants or on the different parts of the greenhouse. And he came back down to the lab and said, the wasps were attracted to the Dixie cups. And I said, no, Fred, you messed up. You must have contaminated the Dixie cups. Go back and do it again. And so he went back and he said, no, I'm sure. I got it all right. I didn't contaminate them. I was very careful. But the wasps just go to the Dixie cups. They go to all the Dixie cups, no matter what's in them, all over the greenhouse. So we scratched our heads about this a while. But what it turns out is that the wasp can learn. And there's there were several talks yesterday in the symposium we had. And so if a wasp finds a larvae and stings it, the wasp learns to associate the odor that it smelled when it found that wasp and stung it with the presence of the host. I mean, when it found the caterpillar and stung it with the presence of the host. This is associative learning. And then it also can recognize the frass or the feces of its own host. It's actually a glycoprotein host recognition chiromone in here. And if it finds a frass of its host and it smells a particular odor, it will learn that odor and associate that odor with the presence of frass. It also will learn locations, colors, objects, and whatever else that it associates with the presence of the host. So the wasps were actually, once they found a host larvae in a Dixie cup, they learned very quickly that Dixie cups are where their hosts were hiding, and so that's why they were going to all the Dixie cups. Well, to make a long story short, Joe and I got a Nature paper out of this by showing that these wasps actually could learn by association, and associative learning was really key for these wasps to find their hosts in a lot of different habitats. And Joe was able to show that you could teach them to fly to almost anything. You can teach them to fly to vanilla extract, chocolate extract, and so forth and so on. And if you, just to give you an idea how this works, if you give them a choice in a wind tunnel, this is the upwind end of the wind tunnel, and you give them a choice of two different sources of odors here. And for example, if you give them the choice of a host feeding on cowpea leaves or a host feeding on cotton leaves, and you release the wasp in the downwind end of the wind tunnel, if they're naive, if you, they've just been come out of the laboratory and haven't had any experience with the host, you don't get a very good response. If you give them one feeding experience on either cotton and corn, you get increase the response tremendously, but they still don't make a choice between the two because there are, of course, some similar odors. But with three experiences like this, then the ones that were trained on cowpea will fly preferentially to the cowpea odor source, and the ones that are fed on cotton will fly preferentially to the cotton odor source. About the same time, I had a student from the Netherlands, Ted Terlinks, working in my lab, and he was trying to figure out what it is that attracts a wasp. And of course, we were still thinking it had something to do with the caterpillars, but he showed very clearly that a caterpillar will fly to a host feeding on a corn leaf in a wind tunnel. But if you'll notice, if I can make it go back, it actually flew here first before it went up and landed on the caterpillar and stung it. So he worked on this quite a bit, and what he was able to show by letting beet iron worms feed on corn seedlings and then taking the beet iron worms off and taking the frass off and testing various components of this host plant complex in a wind tunnel like this was that if you gave the wasps a choice of leaves or frass, they preferred the leaves. Frass or larvae, they preferred the larvae, or leaves and larvae, they preferred the larvae. So it looked like it was actually the plant leaves that were attractive to the caterpillar, to the wasp. But it turns out that it really wasn't the leaves, it had to be damaged leaves. In fact, undamaged leaves weren't as attractive as the larvae, which of course wasn't very attractive at all. These larvae are actually very inconspicuous. So then he did an experiment where he damaged the leaf and he let the caterpillar spit on it. He squeezed the caterpillar and get it to regurgitate or spit on it. And essentially what he found was that the artificial damaged leaves aren't very attractive. The larval damaged leaves are much more attractive than artificial damage. But if he put the spit of the caterpillar on the artificially damaged leaves, then he had something that was essentially equivalent to larval damage. So caterpillar spit on the artificially damaged leaves caused them to be attractive to the wasps, and he then collected volatiles, and basically what he showed that mechanically or artificially damaged leaves don't produce very many volatiles. This is undamaged leaves with spit applied, but mechanically damaged leaves or artificially damaged with spit applied essentially produce the same chromatographic profile as the larval damaged leaves, and the wasps seem to be equally attractive to either one of these sources. So of course we want to know what the spit was and what was in the spit and what the compounds were. So we collected spit from the caterpillars and we isolated and identified this compound, which is 17-hydroxylinolenoyl-L-glutamine. And this was the first insect herbivore produced compound that was a lister of plant volatiles, at least that was not proteinaceous or enzymatic. And it's a simply combination of the amino acid glutamine with a fatty acid linolenic acid, in this case a hydroxylated one. So what we found was that when the caterpillar chews on a plant, there's substances in the spit of the caterpillar that actually induce the plant to synthesize and release volatiles. And this is, you could have put another story together on this, as a matter of fact we did yesterday in the symposia, and these volatile compounds, organic compounds that are released by the plant are used by the beneficial insects as cues to locate their herbivorous hosts. And because the wasps can learn, they can find these host caterpillars on a lot of different plants in a lot of different situations. And this was totally different from what we had started out to look for. It wasn't all what we thought we'd find, but it was a lot more interesting than our original hypothesis. So actually, most of the hypotheses I've come up with in my career are wrong, but the results of the mistakes have been a lot more interesting. I'll just end with this slide here. These are some quotes that I found, and I agree with most of this. The most important thing is not to stop questioning, not to stop asking questions. Some of you may not agree with this, but I tend to agree with it. I think it's much more important to think than it is to read, although graduate students should still have to do literature surveys and literature searches before they do their research. I thought the last one was pretty good. It's a miracle that curiosity survives formal education. All of these are attributed to Albert Einstein, but of course, he was a mathematician. What did he know about biology? Thank you very much. I'm sorry, your question is what about the students working at an interdisciplinary level?
Yes, are they actually working at that level?
Well, in many cases they are, yes. It depends, you know, for example, when I was working with Joe Lewis and Ted Turlings was working in my lab and he was doing a lot of the chemistry, but we were conferring backwards and forth with Joe and students in his lab on the biology. So in that instance, our lab was working more on the chemistry and Joe's was working on the biology. It's not that Ted didn't do some behavioral studies in biology, he did a lot, but a lot of this, he was still a lot of interactions with the people in the other lab. And nowadays, some of my students are working with other scientists in the group. And if you look at in Consuela's lab and her collaboration with Andy Stevenson, I think you'll see their students are getting exposure to both disciplines. I guess if a graduate student has a project, they're going to, of course, be responsible for that project, and perhaps if, even though it's a biological project, they may do some of the chemistry, but in many instances, or vice versa, but in many instances, I think they will be doing an interdisciplinary research.
Yeah, just by virtue of me,
but in some cases, it is really collaborative research. I mean, it just depends for example, when I was doing my research on the Wolvial pheromone, I wasn't doing the bioassays. Dick Hardy was doing the bioassays, and I was doing the chemistry. That was purely interdisciplinary collaborative research. Thank you.